Greetings, friends. This is a recording of a Dhamma talk on the use of metaphor as a teaching tool of the Buddha and how mental fabrications were often portrayed as deities. The malevolent deity Mara was often the metaphor for confused and deluded mind states. This talk was recorded at our Tuesday evening Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey on May 17, 2016. I hope you find benefit from this talk. Peace.
Well, good evening, everyone. We have someone new joining us tonight. This is Darren. Darren, welcome to our Sangha. That's kind of the perfect segue into tonight's talk. Tonight's talk is Mara and Metaphor. I've given the talk once or twice before. I've expanded on the article related to the talk just to include a little bit more background as that relating to metaphor in the Pali Canon and how it's used often. But just for Darren's sake, but again, it's also a tie-in. I teach meditation within a broader framework, and that broader framework is called the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path is the path that the Buddha taught to overcome confused, conditioned thinking and develop a life of lasting peace and happiness. And it's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. The first three are that there is dukkha, there is a general unsatisfactory nature to life due to impermanence and a misunderstanding of the self. Craving and clinging originates and perpetuates that dukkha, that suffering. The third noble truth is that cessation of that suffering is possible, and then there's the path. Very simple, direct truths that are often confused. And part of that confusion comes from, I think, the original use of metaphor, and in particular, metaphorical deities in the Buddha's teaching and then throughout the Pali Canon. And that was, that use of metaphor was adapted and made non-metaphorical for some, what's the right word? Not so skillful reasons. There was always a, from the time of the Buddha to today, there's always been a desire to make a very practical, down-to-earth human teaching off the earth and in other realms and have it hooked that way. And so let me read the article a little bit and then we'll get into it. And I always have to give this disclaimer when I'm talking about these things is I'm not against any of that. It's just not what the Buddha taught. And the Buddha was a human being who taught a way for any other human being who was interested to break through that conditioned thinking and develop a life of lasting peace and happiness. In fact, it's particularly because of his understanding of the common human conditioned thinking that he presented an Eightfold Path. Instead of just saying, there's an underlying disappointing nature to life. It's because of craving and clinging that you create that, and then he just left it at that because he knew that we couldn't overcome it, even though this truth is staring us in the face constantly. We needed a way out, and that's why he developed the Eightfold Path. And the Pali Canon is a set of three books that preserve the teachings of the Buddha, and even that needs a qualification. The first two books are the Sutta Pitaka, which is the collection of the Buddha's direct teachings and some of his senior monks and nuns. The next book is the Vinaya, which is basically a rather lengthy book on monastic discipline and the background for that, but there's also some interesting teachings included in the Vinaya. The third book is called the Abhidhamma, which scholars continue to debate whether that's actually direct teachings of the Buddha or embellishments to the Buddha's teaching that created a more mystical but also a more intricate way of applying the Dhamma. And so I'm one of the believers that I would have a hard time believing that the Buddha actually taught anything in the Abhidhamma because it's a lot of it contradicts what is included throughout his discourses that are contained in the Sutta Pitaka. And the striking thing about that and the way to make sense out of all of those books is to look for the consistency and the relation to the Four Noble Truths. And when you look at it that way, you can very easily and very quickly pick out what the Buddha was teaching and the methods that he was using in relation to that. And so using metaphor, when you look at it in that way, you can't get lost in the metaphor becoming reality. Because everything that Buddha taught was about seeing things clearly. And obviously, these imaginary mind states aren't seeing things clearly. They're used just to point out a mind state. Even the Buddha's, the story of the Buddha's awakening. Now let me read a little bit and then I'll mention that. In the ancient language of the Pali Canon, distracting thoughts arising from clinging conditioned mind are often portrayed as actions of the malevolent deity Mara. The Buddha and the recorders of the Pali Canon often use metaphor when referring to thoughts and thought constructs or fabrications. While referring to a particular individual being, Mara is metaphor for reactive, distracting, and clinging conditioned mind. So the Buddha's awakening, the legend of the Buddha's awakening, is the Buddha spent 6 years wandering around northern India and didn't come to any great understanding, even though he studied with two of the most renowned spiritual teachers of his time, Alara Kalama and Udakas. And they were basically Brahmanical teachers who were rooted in the, who got their understanding from the Vedas, which is the precursor to modern Hinduism, although Hinduism wasn't yet established. It was just this, the Vedas, and then the later kind of Protestant Hindu teachings called the Upanishads. Yes, Bonnie?
Was the Buddha's family Hindu?
No. Hello, Don. No. In fact, the king, the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, was decidedly non-religious. And there's also legend around that he was told before the Buddha was born that he was either going to be a great world leader or a great spiritual teacher, and he didn't like that second. So he tried to keep the Buddha isolated from the world, knowing that if he was ever exposed to the problems of the world, he would want to solve them in a spiritual way rather than a governmental way. But eventually, obviously, the Buddha broke out of that. So the Buddha wandered around northern India studying with these teachers. He developed a very severe ascetic practice that almost killed him. He rejected all that and decided that I'm going to sit in meditation until I awaken. And so with that great resolve, he sat under the Bodhi tree, and 40 days later, the legend goes that he awakened. The story behind that is while the Buddha was meditating, and it's told this way, that the malevolent god Mara kept coming after the Buddha. Mara would come after the Buddha with great armies that would seemingly going to attack the Buddha, and the Buddha would sit there and recognize that this is Mara, the malevolent god. It's not rooted in reality. And he stared down Mara. And the armies would vanish. And then Mara sent trampeding elephants at the Buddha in his meditation. And the story, the Buddha sat there, and the elephants came right up to him and vanished. The Buddha stared down Mara again. Mara sent his three beautiful daughters to entice the Buddha. And the Buddha sat there. He didn't decide to go down to the tavern with these three girls. He sat there. The girls vanished. And this went on and on. These things Mara kept sending at the Buddha. The Buddha sat there recognizing that these were all impermanent mental fabrications, all rooted in desire and all rooted in a self-referential ego personality. Every one of them he saw it as such and rejected it. So the metaphor obviously is Mara. What Mara was representing in the story is the Buddha's still, he's not the Buddha yet, he's still Siddhartha Gautama. So still Siddhartha's unawakened, conditioned mind. But as he faced every one of these thought constructs, recognized them as illusions, or like an illusion, which is the words that he used, they vanished. In other words, they left his mind. They were no longer part of his conditioned thinking. And there's a clue there to how to work the Dhamma. Because all of our deluded thoughts can be categorized as Mara. And if we just look at them clearly through the Eightfold Path, we get to see them as such and we let them go. And so that metaphor stuck of using deities and also to certain groups, the Buddha would use animals if they were animal worshippers. The great discourse, the fire discourse, was given in that way because he was teaching people that were fire worshippers. So he used mental constructs that they were familiar with, but in a different way. He showed them as metaphor rather than reality. These things that you're holding in your consciousness are not real. They're just mental fabrications. And that use of the term mental fabrications is used throughout the Buddha's teaching. He's always referring to these mental constructs that we think are real, and they're just fabrications. And so using metaphor and particularly deities and animals and the environment in that way is brilliant teaching. The problem is that we've created reality out of these metaphorical uses. The use of metaphorical deities as depictions of mind state or mental fabrications is understandable when the cultural and spiritual environment of the time is given consideration. The Buddha was teaching people who were influenced by Brahmin teachers. These were teachers of the Vedas and later the Upanishads, which were the doctrinal precursor to modern Hinduism. The Buddha studied with two respected Brahmanical teachers, Alarika Lama and Uddaka Ramupata. After learning all that they had to offer and mastering their meditation techniques and other rituals and practices they taught, he rejected both teachings as not leading to understanding. Although he rejected the teachings rooted in the Vedas, he realized that many he would be teaching had deeply rooted fabrications based on these common teachings. It was common to associate fabrications with external objects, including gods and goddesses and devas. Also, animals and phenomena such as fire and weather were also used metaphorically. The Buddha used these common beliefs as an expedient. He used common terms in teaching methods in order to instruct people as effectively as possible. His teaching of karma or kama is another example of this. His teachings on karma were contradictory to the prevalent belief, but he used a term that was commonly understood. So the Buddha taught karma, but not in the common usage of the time. But he used a word so people knew what he was referring to. But he wasn't given validity to the common application of karma. He was just using the term to clarify what it really meant in relation to the Four Noble Truths. So karma was taught before the Buddha's teaching in a way that would benefit the teachers. In other words, the more you can benefit the teacher and their teachings, the better your karma would be. And so one way of gaining good karma was to give the teacher a couple of sheep. The Buddha never taught it that way. He didn't ask people for worship or respect in that way. He taught karma simply as the present moment unfolding of your past volitional actions impacted by your present moment consciousness, meaning your present fabrications. So it has nothing to do with gaining merit by gifts or rituals or any of those religious uses of the term. And those religious uses are still prevalent today. In fact, karma is taught more in the Buddhist schools with Hindu connotations even today. Karma is more about gaining merit, and again, you can increase your merit if you do certain things, engage in certain rituals, and even some Buddhist sects, they go so far as to tell you that the more money you give us, the better you're going to be, and you know that is rather common. And I'm not putting anything down or even religion down. And anything that's organized needs money. You know, anything that has a structure needs money. So there's a constant appeal for money in all different ways. Even this room needs the rent to be paid. So it's not a negative thing to ask for money, but it's the kind of the backhanded way that it's presented. In a lot of ways. So the Buddha and his monks, they needed food. And they didn't use any hidden ways of doing that. They went out and they knocked on your door and they said, I'd like to have a bowl of food, please. And if you give me a bowl of food, I'll tell you what I know. And that was the establishment of that almsgiving. And some people decided that they liked what the Buddha and his monks had to offer, and they'd give them a little bit of rice and they'd give them a little teaching. It was an even exchange. Instead of the kind of manipulative way that things have developed. So, it must be remembered that the Buddha never taught anything out of context. Every teaching the Buddha presented was taught in the context of his very first teaching of the Four Noble Truths. The primary purpose of the Buddha's teachings is recognizing and abandoning deluded views rooted in a misunderstanding of the three marks of existence of anicca, anatta, and dukkha. He used metaphor in a way that pointed out the harm that follows from holding these fabrications. So he always depicted, or almost always, there's a few little spots in the Pali Canon where he was using a metaphorically beneficial deity. But it was almost always, and that even fits too. There's some mental constructs that at least initially are helpful. But he almost always used metaphorical deities in a negative way, pointing to the harm that these mental fabrications bring us. He didn't glorify these deities. And he always taught them on in an unelevated way. In other words, he taught these mental fabrications as an aspect of human thinking rather than a deity that's in some kind of higher realm or a type of Buddhist heaven. The legends that grew out around that are even interesting. Some of the stories that give justification for the later developed schools talk about the Buddha going to can't think of it, Talisa. I think it's Tulisa heaven, T-U-L-I-S-A, heaven, where the Buddha would go there so he could teach the gods and the goddesses in the higher realms. And then even some of the stories are kind of silly to say. And like he came back down to earth at lunchtime and had his lunch, and then he went back up there. If you think about it, I mean, this is how it's depicted. None of it makes a lot of sense. For one thing, if the Buddha was able to travel to all these different realms, he probably didn't need to have a sandwich at noon. But he... Everything the Buddha taught was grounded in his depiction of himself. He never elevated himself to anything above a human being. And because of that, he would not have taught that I'm going away for a couple hours and I'm going to this Buddhist heaven and I'm going to talk to the gods and I'll see you later. It just doesn't fit in with the rest of his teachings. And there's nothing that he ever taught that would relate to that. He consistently said about his teachings, I teach the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering, nothing more. And then he described that suffering as arriving and craving and clinging, not as a misunderstanding or a lack of appeal to gods and goddesses. He never introduced worship of any kind as a way of developing awakening. He consistently gave an eightfold path and referred back to that eightfold path. He never placed any validity at all on appeasing to disincarnate beings or deities or gods. Even in some of the later recordings in the Pali Canon have the Buddha, has this phrase, the Buddha taught gods and men. But it's always taught, if you look at it closely, it's always taught in that context that gods and men were the same. Meaning what he's teaching is this confused, and then going back to the use of metaphor throughout the canon, a god was a metaphor for a confused mind state, not an exalted being to appease. It was always depicted that way. So the Buddha taught gods and men, meaning the Buddha taught confused mind states of men, not elevated beings. And again, when you wanted to create a more mystical or magical type of teaching, this was perfect to use these. Bonnie, you had a question?
Yes.
I thought you had your hand up.
Yes.
I talked you past it. I'm sorry.
I have it. But so a lot of the statues and deities that came later, like things like Kuan Yin,
mm-hmm,
and Saraswati, those are Hindu?
No, there's a lot of crossover. There's a lot of crossover too. So Kuan Yin is a perfect example. Kuan Yin is the female deity. The Avalokiteshvara is the male Kuan Yin, and it's usually depicted as this being with a bunch of different arms and stuff, and in a very general way as a savior. I think Kuan Yin is known as the goddess of compassion, etc. So there's all kinds of different connotations of that same spiritual deity. Kuan Yin is Chinese in origin, and it fits in with the Agamas, which were the Chinese adaptations to the Pali Canon, and it fits in with the culture of the time. Avalokiteshvara is a Tibetan god, and it fits in with that. Especially if you go to the what's that museum? Tibet House? No.
New York.
Yeah.
On
23rd Street, I think it is.
Yeah.
Well, if you think of it, it's a beautiful museum with a lot of, it's about Tibetan Buddhism, and what they have in there is amazing. I mean, some of these paintings are so intricate, but they're way after the Buddha's teaching, and they were related to the prevalent religions of Tibet at the time that Buddhism moved in, which is the ancient Bon religion, B-O-N. and their own Lamaism. Tibetan Buddhism wasn't even called that until a couple hundred years ago. It was always the Lama religion, Tibetan Lamaism, hence the name Dalai Lama, etc. It was only as it became integrated into the West that they started attaching the Buddhist appellation to Tibetan religion. So all of those statues and deities are all part of later developed religions, and they were common in those religions. So one of the things, I probably won't get to it because this is a long article and I'm talking about a lot of different subjects. About 200, 250 years after the Buddha's death, there was the Buddha Sangha was still intact, and they were still practicing pretty closely to what the Buddha taught. They kept very closely to it, and they used the Vinaya Pitaka to maintain that, the rules that the Buddha had established when he was alive. There was a group called the Mahasanghikas, who wanted a more visionary and mystical type of Buddhism. And they wanted to establish the Buddha as a god and as one of an infinite number of Buddhas that stretched infinitely into the past and infinitely into the future. Obviously something the Buddha never taught. But they were so bent on establishing this as part of a Buddhist religion, even though it contradicted it, that they started using metaphor, the metaphors that the Buddha and the other recorders use, as reality. And so they started to refer to these metaphorical gods as real gods. And what followed was things like Kuan Yin and Avalokiteshvara. There's an infinite number of gods. And some of the Tibetan Buddhist schools, you would have a hard time counting all the different gods and goddesses that they use. Again, this is just to point out the differences. The Buddha never established anything above the human realm as far as developing human understanding. And again, getting back to tonight's talk, he used metaphor to depict mental fabrications, not as higher realms. Let me read a little bit further, but I want to comment on that too, because it's important, about how from the Mahasanghika sect and their desire for a more mystical type of Buddhism led to almost directly, you can trace it through different writings, led to almost directly to the Mahayana versions of Buddhism today. I may have read this just a moment ago, but I'm going to go back. Buddha used metaphor in a way that pointed out the harm that follows from holding these fabrications, depicting deities not as actual benevolent beings to be worshipped, but as malevolent fabrications to be recognized as such and abandoned. The Buddha consistently described his Dhamma as understanding suffering and developing the cessation of suffering. The second noble truth shows that it is craving for the establishment of an ego personality, or that which the Buddha said is anatta, and clinging to this establishment that originates and continues suffering. Paramount to this understanding or conceit, is understanding, conceit, or eye-making. Sorry about that. It is through mental fabrications that deluded views of a permanent self arise and are maintained. So do you see how using metaphor to explain mental fabrications and then taking that and creating a reality out of those metaphors is more eye-making? We're creating a reality as a repository for the self, or creating our own awakening as human beings, dependent more on gods and goddesses than it is on a direct inquiry into the nature of self. And does everybody see that? Because that's pretty subtle, but it's so important in understanding the difference.
Most of the time when I see those descriptions in the suttas, he refers to these devas and brahmas as just as deluded as human beings. They're just living in better quarters.
Yep, he never portrays a so-called deity in the way that we might in the West. You know, we always see gods as something to aspire to, and something to appease, and something to get in your favor. And even the metaphorical supreme beings in our movies are portrayed the same way as somebody you want. Even Darth Vader, you see where I'm going? You want to get Darth Vader on your side too, even though he's a bad guy, because he can do you some benefit. Well, we've created religions out of that same idea. We want to get on the good side of these deities because they hold some power over us in some way. The Buddha is just using them to portray mental fabrications in a way to show the the unskillfulness of doing that. Again, remember, he was teaching people that were if they were spiritual at all, not everybody was, they were spiritual believers in malevolent and benevolent deities. And so he was using their own mental fabrications to show them just what it is that they're holding in their minds and in their hearts, to show that that's a confused view. And from that has developed even more confused views in the name. And I know when I say it that way, it sounds like I'm putting down other things. I'm just pointing out the difference. I got to keep qualifying that. So let me just read a couple of stories, and then I want to talk a little bit about the Mahasanghikas. As Buddhism spread from northern India, the use of metaphor was given more significance as the Buddhist teachings were adapted and accommodated into cultural conventions and charismatic individual views. Often, metaphorical objects were now used to give authenticity to the desire for a more mystical and esoteric dharma. These views that the Buddha taught were to be recognized as rooted in ignorance and were to be abandoned were now given validity as god objects to be mollified or gain favor from through generating merit. Metaphorical malevolent deities were now overseeing gods and goddesses, holding the power to grant favors and draw one towards exalted mind states, further contradicting the Buddhist teachings of personal individual responsibility for developing individual understanding, just as he had. So he had to overcome the rooted beliefs in these deities as reality too. I mean, it was part of what he was brought up with. It was part of what he was taught directly. And again, he realized that these were just creating more confusion in his own mind. This metaphor has been further stretched to include awakened charismatic Buddhist teachers who now had the magical power to transfer understanding directly to another mind without the individual development of the Eightfold Path. And that's a rather common practice today, that a teacher who has the right lineage and was given the right empowerment, to use the word, can transfer the awakening directly from one mind to another mind. And of course, the Buddha never tried that, and he never could do it, or at least there's no depictions that he actually could transmit awakening from mind to mind. And if he could do that, he would have simply done it to all humanity, wouldn't he? He wouldn't have played games around that one. He would have said, "I got it, I can give it to you," and he would just do it. He couldn't do it, so what he did was he taught a way for individuals to develop that awakening on themselves, for themselves. That desire to overlook the Buddhist teachings on the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path, and using higher beings, now allowed for this type of priestly power where there was none. The Buddha never set himself above anybody else except in the way that he had an understanding. And he taught his monks and nuns to do exactly the same thing. But common in that culture and still today, the Brahmanical priests were seen as somebody who were at the highest class of society. And they were compensated as such, and they were treated as such. They were treated with great respect simply because someone decided they were Brahmins. That hierarchy continues today, and not just in Buddhism. It continues in just about every religion. It's necessary for religion to establish itself that way. There needs to be a hierarchy if there's going to be a religion. The Buddha had no intention of starting a religion, so he had no need for a hierarchy. In fact, what was most important for the Buddha was to portray himself as a human being so that other people could understand they could do the same thing that this human being did. That's the real teaching of the Ratana Sutta and the Three Refuges. We take refuge in the idea that a human being did this, not some exalted god and one of an infinite number of gods. What good is that teaching? And isn't that ultimately off-putting, that if the teacher is setting himself up as something other than you, how can he teach you something, anything useful, except to worship him and hope to gain favor in him? The Buddha never did that. He taught a very simple and direct way for people to gain full maturity. As a result of confusing metaphor for objects to be worshipped, the Buddha's direct teaching has been diminished in importance in favor of culturally and individually influenced views of what a Buddhist religion should be. Complete with powerful priests, wrathful and peaceful deities, and higher realms of consciousness to achieve. Often appeasing deities and achieving higher realms of consciousness are taught as intermediary steps that at some point can be abandoned. So a lot of these things, modern teachers, I guess, they understand the awkwardness of teaching deity worship. And so they teach it often in this way, that it's just a way of keeping you focused until you don't need this understanding anymore, and then you can let go of this practice. Why teach it in the first place? And I remember being taught that by a very well-respected Tibetan teacher, and that was really my reaction, and I questioned him on it, and I found that you shouldn't question that, but it was a reasonable question. If you're teaching me something that I need to spend a lot of effort in mastering solely to get to the point where I let it go, why do I need to do it? You know, I'm interested, even then, even in my confused state, I said, I'm interested in awakening now. I am not interested in awakening in the way it was taught, infinite lifetimes in the future. Even that didn't make any sense to me. Part of that confusion led me to look at what the Buddha actually taught, because I couldn't believe that a human being who is attempting to teach humanity how to end suffering would teach intermediary steps, which are just confusing. But it's a common practice today. And it's explained away. Well, you let it go when you have enough understanding. The Eightfold Path is the direct path to that understanding. And the problem with that is that a new self-referential identity has now been fabricated in what was originally a metaphorical object. Metaphor now has, in fact, become more important, a more important focus than the direct teachings of the founder. So the idea that if I light enough candles and pray long enough to Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara, such a hard thing to say, and I do that long enough, and I'm devoted enough to this, and create enough images, you know, and then the meditation is taught to bring this image of Avalokiteshvara into your mind and focus on that, and you do this long enough. Doesn't this sound like it's very misleading and confusing? This practice that is often taught that way, rather than develop a meditation method that develops deepening concentration so that you can have the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the Eightfold Path. That's what the Buddha taught. Rather than this confusing, multi-layer, multifaceted deity worship and deity appeasement. Again, all rooted back in this original use of metaphor. Later developed Buddhist doctrine has its roots in the Mahasanghikas. A few hundred years after the Buddha's death, the Mahasanghikas split from the monks and nuns who were maintaining the Buddha's teachings. This split occurred over the Mahasanghikas' desire to relax some of the monastic rules and the desire to establish a more mystical and visionary form of Buddhism. This included establishing the Buddha as a god who is one of an endless lineage of Buddhas, extending infinitely to the past and the future. This served to both elevate the Buddha in a way that he avoided as a distraction and diminish his teaching as an individual Dhamma in favor of following a religion rooted in mystical metaphor and special rituals and esoteric practices. Metaphor now became reality, and the establishment of beliefs, rituals, and practices that would continue eye-making was encouraged rather than seen as rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha taught that what is commonly thought of as a self is anatta, not a self. Anatta is the result of an ignorant view of reality and the clinging interaction of a distracted and deluded mind with impermanent phenomena. It is the hardened belief in the fabrications produced by anatta, by clinging mind, that result in the overall unsatisfactory experience of human life. This hardened belief in anatta as the self is as deluded as the belief in mara, and as anything more than a fabrication of Siddhartha Gautama's unawakened mind, which is how he depicted it. It is the same delusion that continues the belief in anatta that gives rise to mara, or thought constructs that would only further distraction, confusion, and suffering. So it is useful, if you see this clearly, to see your own confused mental fabrications as this malevolent god mara, and something simply to be abandoned, not something to worship or even put too much consideration into. So this is one of two suttas that I cited in this article. In the Kapha Sutta, Kapha questions the Buddha using metaphor. For one stranded in the middle of a lake with a constant danger of drowning, where is the island of lasting safety? So being stranded in a lake is metaphor for the continual experience of dukkha while wandering aimlessly in samsara. The Buddha responds, lasting safety is possible. Have nothing, cling to nothing, abandon all that is anatta. Release is the, these are the Buddha's words, release is the island. There is no other island. Release is the island. Release is the culmination of the Eightfold Path. And he's saying there is no other safety. There is no other refuge. Speaking directly to this metaphor. Again, the Buddha continues, unbinding, releasing yourself from craving and clinging and ignorant views, unbinding brings a complete cessation to all confusion and suffering. Unbinding brings complete cessation to the pain of wandering aimlessly in samsara. Understanding suffering, abandoning craving and clinging, knowing cessation, developing the Eightfold Path, fully mindful, non-distracted, fully unbound, these don't become Mara's servants. These don't become more mental fabrications. These are no longer distracted by those mental fabrications, or the Buddha's words, where these are no longer distracted by Mara. So he's very clearly using metaphor in a way that's easily seen as metaphor and not as trying to appease a god or goddesses. Is that clear? That simple sutta. There's another one. It's another quick sutta. I like this one for one of the reasons is that Vajira, it's about Vajira who's a nun, and I'm always interested in how the nuns were depicted in the Pali Canon rather than the way they were hoped to be predicted, meaning that they were unimportant to the Buddha Sangha. There's many stories of important nuns having important stories in the canon. The Vajira Sutta is another example of the use of metaphor in presenting a similar teaching. Vajira is sitting in meditation when the distraction of doubt and conjecture arise. Rather than engaging in further conjecture, Vajira, well grounded in the Dhamma, recognizes doubt and conjecture as aspects of clinging conditioned mind. And again, referring that aspect of her clinging conditioned mind as Mara. The Mara approaches Vajira in meditation. A mental fabrication that is rooted in ignorance arises in Vajira's mind. Who originated this living being? This is Mara questioning Vajira, or Vajira questioning, looking at her own confused state of mind. Who originated this living being? Where is this living being's maker? Where does this living being cease? Vajira recognizes these thoughts are arising from a deluded and clinging conditioned mind. And she responds, this is Mara, the evil one. Mara, it is you that is deluded by assuming a living being. Your position, your view, is a twisted mass of mental fabrications. Again, certainly not elevating Mara to some godlike state. A twisted mass of mental fabrications is how Vajira is seeing this metaphorical deity. There is no living being here that can be permanently established. It is only in the assembling of the parts of a chariot that a chariot is established. And there's another story where if you take apart a chariot, it's no longer a chariot, it's just a bunch of parts, relating to the five clinging aggregates. It is only in the assembling of the parts of a chariot that a chariot is established. So it is that when five aggregates are present, do you declare a living being? What you declare as a living being is only stress that has arisen. Craving and clinging to views is its cause. Nothing but stress arises and nothing but stress falls away. There is nothing here that you declare but clinging, craving, and stress. Under the declaration of understanding, Mara vanishes. Vajira's mind finally clears. She sees things clear. She saw the mental fabrications for what they are. She let them go. Her mind cleared. The metaphor is that this malevolent god Mara now left her consciousness. It's a perfect metaphor when used that way and seen correctly, isn't it? It is often portrayed that the Buddha taught gods and men the same Dhamma, showing that there is no difference between confused mind states that are considered super mundane and mundane. A passage from the Samyutta Nikaya 1.23, the Buddha uses metaphor directly portraying a confused mind as a diva approaching the Buddha. The diva inquires of the Buddha regarding the entanglements of the world. A tangle inside, a tangle outside, this world is entangled in a tangle. I ask you this, Gotama, who can disentangle this tangle? So the inference there is that this exalted, malevolent mind state will get the answer, reaffirming itself. Do you see where that mind state might be going? Well, it's going to be you that's going to get me out of this tangle, your confused mind state, rather than the Buddha does not teach to appease deities or aspire to a higher mental realm. He teaches to recognize directly confused and deluded thinking in the context of the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha's response, One who is wise, established on virtue, developing the mind in wisdom, one who is ardent and discerning, they can disentangle this tangle. Not a god or a goddess or another realm, or entering another realm. Those in whom lust and hatred along with ignorance have been expunged, their fabrications destroyed, for these the tangle is disentangled. So remember, the Buddha taught one path, to disentangle his tangle, the Eightfold Path. He didn't teach appeasement. He didn't put an overemphasis on metaphor. He just used metaphorical deities to show where confused, deluded thinking can take us and to depict them in, I think, a very useful way. So that's about half of the, well, it's about three quarters of the article if you want to go further, but that's really the point. I think I made it over and over again. but it's an important one. You know, I think we all can get lost if we don't see these things clearly, like the use of metaphor, the use of higher realms and all those types of things. The Buddha taught a human path to awakening. No special powers, no special empowerments, no special teachers needed. But an individual wholehearted engagement with the path is what's required. And that's one of the reasons why I think that it was altered. Because anatta, a self-referential ego self, doesn't want to do anything that would diminish itself. It would much rather attach itself to concepts that allow it to continue in its confused state rather than change and look at itself in an honest way. Liz?
So, in other words, the Buddha was teaching these metaphors and relationships to, in relationship to deities that existed. So it was within the context of the day.
Well, no. Not deities that existed, deities that existed as metaphor.
Right.
Yes. So, yes, I would say yes, that's
well, deities
correct.
That people believe were a manifestation. They believed in these.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So yes. He was creating these metaphors based on these deities within the context of the time that he was telling the story.
Yes. In a way that people could then relate to it directly. They could see that, yes, this is how I used to think of this. Mm-hmm. And now the Buddha's explaining that those are just mental fabrications.
Was Mara known outside of the Buddhist teachings?
Well, I don't know if that word was used, but I think every religion has a Mara-like creature. I mean, Christianities would see Mara as the devil, probably,
sure.
Or Lucifer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always that.
If he came up with you know, the concept of Mara.
Mara was well established within the Vedas.
Okay.
You know, in fact, Mara is one of the infinite number of gods and goddesses that are included in that. And it is interesting how there's components of that in just about every religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think I was talking last week about Krishnamurti. One of his problems with the theosophists, Madame Blavatsky and Ledbetter and the rest of them, was that even though they were hoping to establish Buddhism as the major world religion, they were only interested in doing it in an all-encompassing way. In other words, they took the parts of Tibetan. I don't think they tried to incorporate Zen or the other, because they weren't well established back then. This was in the late 1800s. But they tried to incorporate Tibetan Buddhism in a Western way, and then they tried to teach this to Krishnamurti, and eventually he got to the point where he said, I can't accept that part of it. But what he continued to teach for the rest of his life was a very stripped-down type of Buddhism, even though he never mentioned I don't think he ever mentioned the Eightfold Path. And again, it was just as an expedient to the time, and those times are still here today, aren't they? Most religions are based in some way. Certainly, again, I'm not putting any of it down, but certainly Christian religion is based on the three supreme beings, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I can't think of one religion that is not based on that, on having external gods and goddesses. So, and the Buddha never said those are wrong. He just said in relation to his Dhamma, they're wrong views. I've never, ever heard anyone where the Buddha said, you can't be a Hindu and be a Buddhist. But he did point out the differences and the contradictions. Bonnie?
Was it seen as controversial?
Oh, the Buddha, yeah. He was the...
Questioning how they were... He was not holding up the deity to a certain height.
he was probably the premier radical of his time, and there were difficulties for him in holding that. You know, it wasn't something that I ever could infer that he was proud of or was trying to achieve. I don't think he liked controversy, but he also understood that in his role, he couldn't avoid it either. It was, you know, and not that I'm putting myself in his class. I had to come to that realization too. If I was going to teach something and be authentic to it, I had to not be too concerned about some of the remarks that I get back. You know, this is just what it is, and it's not something else. It would be wonderful if you could say, oh, it's all, and it's often portrayed, oh, everything really is the same, and all religions get to the same point, and, you know, maybe they do, but I don't believe that, and apparently the Buddha didn't either, because he spent as much time saying what his teaching wasn't as he did teaching what it was. You know, and this is another good example. Using a common belief but of his time, but in a very uncommon, contradictory way. And that's probably the most important teaching about understanding the use of metaphor in the Buddha's time and throughout the Pali Canon. Because Mara keeps coming back over and over again in the Pali Canon. There's hundreds and hundreds of references. Again, always pointing out Mara as a mental fabrication and not as something to chase after or aspire to. I've had some people say that they, online students, I think one person came up to me in class about a year ago too, saying when they finally realized this, that it was very, very depressing to them. You know, it took a while to realize and overcome that initial understanding that, you know, all my beliefs were wrong. It's hard to accept that. You know, we don't have to do it all at once. But, you know, I struggled with the idea of a higher supreme being all my life. I remember being a little kid thinking, you know, just how does this apply, and how does it work for me? And that creates this kind of mindset where you're always trying to do things, then, at least in my mind, do things to appease the supreme creator God that sees everything I do. And it became very, very agitating and a very inauthentic way for me to live. And then I got, one of the great things that I learned when I was young is that if I did a lot of things that screwed up and were contrary and that this God might not really like, I could go and talk to one of his agents and I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I can't help it. That I could be given a dispensation by saying and doing a few rituals, and then no matter what I did, it would all be okay. And it just didn't make sense to me. And the reason why it didn't make sense to me is because, and I didn't understand it at the time, I was still hurting inside. You know, I was still engaged in activity that was hurtful to me and to other people. How can it be that I can do a couple of rituals, I can say a few specific prayers, and somehow I'm healed? When I tried it, I went into the little booth, I got the prayers to say, I said the prayers, and I still felt awful. I still felt confused. I still was full of fear. I still couldn't sleep at night. It didn't make sense. And then as I got into Buddhism, I found almost exactly the same thing. And so it still didn't make any sense to me, and it didn't give me any comfort or understanding. And then when I read what the Buddha taught, that here's a path for developing myself and ending in myself all of those fears, all of that hurt, all of that confusion, by seeing things clearly. And it had nothing to do with appeasement or ritual or anything else. But it did have to do with developing developing right meditation within the other seven factors of this path. And that it made sense. That I could sink my teeth in. It was something that I could do. It was something that I was also responsible for. And when you look at the Buddha's history and what he did coming up to that point of awakening, that was exactly his frustrations. He wanted to find a way that he could work within his own mind and develop his own understanding. He wasn't interested in having that given to him because he felt that was unauthentic. You know, again, so there's a difference between what the Buddha taught and every other religion I've ever looked at. And it's not to put down other religions. Religions serve their purpose. They're just not about human awakening. And that's the end of that. Any other questions about that? Does this make anybody uneasy? Please be honest with me. Cause I,
why would it make me uneasy?
Well, some people have told me that it does, and that's okay. I mean, I, but I don't have
any belief in any higher realms and gods and stuff, so it's not controversial to me.
Okay. Nobody else?
I think one of the differences for me, anyway, was that as I was going through my religious education, if you went into confession and you received confession, you felt the absolution, but you didn't always know exactly what you needed to do when you got out of there to change it. Because sometimes, you sort of stumbled into a situation where you were not where you were supposed to be or whatever. Yeah. And then if you went in and got absolution, it didn't necessarily give you the guidance on how to avoid that necessarily the next time.
Yeah.
And it, you know, just being very punitive based and, you know, in our Catholic upbringing, we didn't read the Bible. We didn't, you know, that wasn't part of our religious upbringing. So there weren't the at least for me, there weren't the storytelling. There wasn't the example. There wasn't, you know.
You were just told what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, but a lot of our moral upbringing came from our parents anyway. I mean,
yeah.
And that was based on their upbringing within the Christian, you know, Catholic faith. But the thing that I like about this is that it is so practical. And I think when you say wrong view, again, it's not a well, how is it that you say that? It's not wrong view in that you might feel it's you're being wrong, but you're just not following the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, it probably.
How is it that you say that so eloquently, sir?
If I was as eloquent years ago when I first started teaching, I would have used the words unskillful and skillful rather than right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's too late in the game to change it now. I'd have to go. But that really is a better depiction. Skillful or unskillful, a wrong view is simply an unskillful view, meaning that it you haven't developed the skills yet to see things skillfully.
Right. And when we talked about the Eightfold Path and the virtuous elements of the Eightfold Path, I remember Ron brought up, you know, virtuous, you know, I don't know, because it made it sound holier than thou or somehow, but it really is just about having the knowledge.
Yeah, and remaining harmless.
Knowledge.
Yeah.
And it keeps it away, using skillful and harmless, keeps it away from this good and bad classification, which is like what your mind wants to go into. This is good, this is bad, I do the good stuff, I don't do the bad stuff. Instead of thinking, this is the skillful way to get where I want to go.
Yeah, and that's the problem with words, too. I do remember considering using skillful and unskillful, but the words right and wrong do get right to the heart of the matter, even though they do have more moral connotations about
them. They
sound
more Catholic-based.
Well, yeah, but again, who am I talking to? You know, really. I mean, it was as little as I could integrate. You know, I learned a lot about how to teach this by reading how the Buddha taught it. And again, I might have wanted to use the word skillful and unskillful, and I still do. I mean, I occasionally will present it that way. But right and wrong is how we tend to see things, rather than skillful and unskillful. In the book, I talk about, and I talked about it here when we went through the course, that there's a task associated with each factor of the Eightfold Path, and that's to develop the skill. Like the skill of right effort is developing a meditation practice. These are skills that we develop. So a skillful effort is engaging in this right effort, this effort that leads to the completion of the path, rather than wrong effort, which would be, you know, watching the ball game and eating bonbons or something. That's not necessarily morally wrong, but as it relates to effort, it's wrong effort. It's unskillful effort. So it's not always that moral connotation. You also mentioned about that getting absolution and that whole idea. I couldn't figure out, now that I've gotten this absolution. I took a nickel's worth of candy from Grandma, and now I've gotten absolution. How come I feel like doing it again? And I did. And that really left me confused. It left me thinking that there's no hope for me. When I die, I'm spending eternity in hell, because that's what I was taught. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's true. I mean, I may find that, you know, I'm closer to hell than I am to heaven, I think. But
that's all the fun people are doing.
So, you know, I could find that the Buddha was right, but so was Father, what was his name? Father Fagan. You know, he was right too. They both were. I achieved some nice lasting peace and happiness in my human life, but I'm spending the rest of eternity with the devil. But I honestly don't really believe that. It just doesn't make sense. One of the things that Krishnamurti said, that the reason why he said that Buddhism was the closest thing to a religion that he would consider, which is, by the way, what Einstein said, in slightly different words, is because it applied to us right now. You know, this is for right now. One of the things that I realized about my Christian upbringing is that I really was the kind of person that followed the Ten Commandments without, except when I was a little kid, without having to put too much thought to it. But that didn't leave me with lasting peace and happiness, and that was the problem with it. And you just alluded to that. So I wanted something that I could develop that in my life. And I knew at an early age, not consciously, that the chasing acquisitions and power and scholastic or sports-based achievements was not going to give that to me, even though that was taught that. And that's, again, there's nothing wrong with it, except when you use that as a substitution for your own self-worth and your own lasting peace and happiness. Bonnie?
I think for me, the whole... Well, I was raised in a conservative Orthodox Jewish family and community where I don't think it's different, where it's about this something outside of you that, you know, like people say, well, it's God's will. And whereas I feel like following or beginning to practice this is about, even though it's weird because there's an irony in the out I'm making, it's really about the self. I'm responsible for the actions that happen to me. So whether it's good or it's successful or I have failures, I'm responsible, as opposed to like, I'm just asking for God to help me or he's going to do it. It was like, well, you know, it's sort of wrestling with that idea that if I want to ask for something, for some strength, so that I can have this, right, I don't know. Do you know what?
Oh, yeah. I
feel like also, like the difference between if I say a prayer, which to me feels like, say, an old prayer, it feels like I'm warding off evil.
Yeah.
When I say the metta prayer, or the metta for myself, it helps sort of ground me in the present about what's really possible.
Yeah.
So it really has, for me, a qualitative difference in how it helps me to address the things I need to be of right mind.
Yeah, and that's exactly what metta is presented that way. I call it an intentional meditation. Or an intentional prayer. The workshops that I teach for the 12-step workshops and mindfulness-based recovery, prayer is often presented as part of that. And to me, prayer in Buddhism, the way the Buddha taught it, is simply stating a strong intention, which is what any prayer is. And in this case, metta is used as to point out the, an aspiration and also the result of an awakened human being. That's how an awakened human being should would act, and it's how we should act as we're moving towards that. And the Santa Claus use of God, you know, I need this, I need that, always seemed ridiculous. And then you see, you can't reconcile, to me, I couldn't reconcile all the contradictions. You know, how do we have gigantic earthquakes and floods that kill people? How are millions of people starving to death or have some illness that dies if there's a supreme creator? How could that be? It doesn't make sense. Maybe there is. You know, and one of the ways that I've even thought about it is maybe there is an individual force that created everything and then just got out of the way to see what happens. Maybe. I mean, that would make sense to me. I don't know if it makes sense. I could accept that point of view. But to think that there is an individual that is somehow manipulating things for each and every one of us in certain ways and yet allows things like these terrible tragedies or child molestation, all the other awful. How could that never could make sense to me?
And you're supposed to stay in the good graces of this.
Yeah, I was taught that, you know, I better keep this dude pretty happy because he's gonna come after me. And then you get that whole idea that you know, whatever happens is God's will. Well, then I don't have to do anything. You know, I don't have to do anything. I can wait for the will to change, and my life will change. I'm getting into something I shouldn't get into, the contradictions of religion, but the whole point that I'm hoping to make, and I think I made it, is that there's a difference between what the Buddha taught and religion, period. And the way he used metaphor shows that exactly, Don.
I find the whole thing with gods and goddesses and personifying a higher being, to me, looking at it more from a more anthropological viewpoint, seems to be that, you know, we are creatures that we know that, we understand that we're going to be dead. We know that we're only here for a limited amount. We know we're our demise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when other animals see other animals dead, they don't assume that they're going to die as well. We do. So that, for me, that understanding kind of simplifies why religion is what it is. Because
no matter how bad our life is, we got an opportunity to have a real good one forever.
I understand that someday I'm going to die. So of course that brings, as a young person anyway, a younger person, it brought up tremendous fear. My ego doesn't want to die as well.
Yeah.
My ego does a lot to keep itself going. Even though it's something that I created myself, or this entity created itself. So this is why, for me, what we do here and what I've gotten from your workshop so far makes so much more sense. Because all that stuff does nothing but create stress for me.
Well, and I think...
And this is all about eliminating stress.
You're getting
so
into
holding on to a concept, I'm able to let go of it. Understand it, accept it, and let go of it.
We can, the philosophical debate about how and why religions developed and continue, we could go on and on about that, but it was the Buddha's first encounter with human death that set him off on his path for understanding. He saw that dead old man laying on the side of the road, and it finally hit him. If we're all going to end up like this, and in his case, it was, you know, he was giving himself 35 more years, maybe 40. You know, that was a long life expectancy back then. In 40 years, I'm going to be like that. What's the use of all this? What's the meaning? Why do I care if I'm a king's son or the poorest person on the planet? Because in the end, you can't take anything with you. How does this make sense? And it was that idea of his own mortality that set him out in an earnest pursuit of understanding. And 6 years later, he figured it out by trying all different types of religions, different meditation practices, different ascetic practices that were very common at the time. And he finally came to the realization that there's four truths that we can live by. There is an unsatisfactory nature to life. Don't crave for anything more and don't cling to that. And develop the refined mindfulness that's rooted in deep concentration of the Eightfold Path. Why? To put aside all conditioned thinking that's rooted in those other things, in those beliefs that somehow I can establish this ego personality forever and ever and ever, through endless heavens, through endless Buddhas, through endless rituals. I can keep it going. I can keep it going. Mantra, 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 you know. Bowing, bowing, bowing. Keep it going, keep it going. Maintain the ego personality. What is it? It's just agitation. It's just that man laying on the side of the road with not a breath left in him. The Buddha taught to live right now while we have a breath in us. And he taught us how to live a life of lasting peace and happiness while we're still breathing. You know, as they say, as we're still on the right side of the dirt. You know, he wasn't concerned about those other things. Here goes the qualification. So even if there is something, so what? I mean, I remember having this thought very clearly. I was probably 28 years old. Even if there is something after death, do I want to spend my whole life trying to get there? Or do I want to find a way to live my life right now? And at the age of 28, I wasn't very happy with the way I was living my life. I mean, it sucked. But I wanted that moment to be meaningful rather than trying to do something that would get me, you know, at the time I thought I'd live to at least 100. I hope I don't now, but that would get me there, you know? Oh, boy. You don't know what it's like to wake up in this body. this is what the Buddha saw. That's what motivated him to develop this understanding. He didn't care about the future. The common teaching of rebirth was reincarnation. Do everything you can in this life for a favorable birth. It's still taught today. The Buddha said, that's hogwash. I want to learn how to live now. This is the only life that I know that I have. Everything else is conjecture. How do I live with a peaceful mind now? How do I stop competing with everyone else for the establishment of my ego? I mean, he used a different term, but how do I stop doing that? It doesn't make me happy to constantly think that I have to be better than you. Or I have to avoid being, you know, it's still that caste system. I have to avoid falling down into that category of person. It didn't make sense to him. And when he started his teaching, he taught everyone. He taught from the lowest to the low to the most exalted people. He didn't see any difference because he didn't see any difference in himself and another person. He taught a path for human beings, all human beings, to awaken without the need for you to be born in a special place or a special body or a special lineage or to have a special teacher or even a special dharma. He didn't protect his teachings like other people protected it. His famous quote is, I'm not like a teacher with a closed fist. Everything I teach is out there. It's open. You don't need any specialness. You don't need a higher intelligence. You don't need the right birth family. Anybody. And he did that. You talked about being a radical. A lot of the difficulties the Buddha faced was because he was giving spiritual teachings to people that did not deserve it. At least that was the common refrain. You can't teach those people that. They don't deserve it. And then he did the worst thing possible. He took nuns into his sangha. It was unheard of to teach women anything like this. But he did it. He almost lost his life a few times over it. But he did it. He did it because it was the humanly right thing to do, not the morally right thing to do. You know, it was what an awakened human being would do. So, that's a long talk on marrow and metaphor. I was thinking, I spent a lot of time.
You gotta save something for the weekend.
Well, I was thinking, see how Marin, this is a quick class tonight. Sorry about that, folks. I hope it was useful to you. I hope you got some understanding about the use of metaphor and the Buddhist teachings and what it's led to. So let's meditate before it gets too late. We'll go around the room. So, Darren, excuse the long and I hope you're able to at least a little bit tie it into the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, but maybe not. It might seem like it's taken out of context, but remember that everything the Buddha taught for 45 years was taught in the context of the Eightfold Path and in context of the Four Noble Truths and to develop the Eightfold Path. So what we're going to do right now, meditation, is one factor of eight. There is a pamphlet out there, and there's on my website, you can go to the tab that says New Visitors, and that will give you a general background about what to look at to get a little bit more perspective on what we teach here. But the meditation method is called Shamatha Vipassana Meditation. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight. And it's that insight into the nature of self and the environment that that self lives in that we're looking for. Forget about what I just said, but just understand that it's a specific type of insight. It's not just, we're not looking for aha moments only. The meditation method is focused on the breath. We maintain focus on the breath to develop concentration primarily. So I'll talk us all into it. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And holding your back straight but not stiff, your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel, and holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room, settle into your bodies, and settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath and your body. And if you can pick up your breath right at the tip of your nose, place your mindfulness there. And while remaining mindful of your breath and your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by our own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.